Thanks, Gina. It's great to be. Let's see if I get this right. It's great to be back here in Santa Barbara. Sorry, I can't stay longer. And now I have to go back and teach and all that. But it was nice to even be here for this week. Before I get into some of the research, just a little bit of words about my affiliation that I have. So the School of Earth and Space Exploration is a brand new department that we have here at ASU, and it unites these three fields here. So there's us astronomers, and we're in with geologists and a few engineers, and the idea is to sort of trace sort of how we got here all the way from, like, you know, Big Bang kind of cosmology questions to, like,
the old department.
What happened to the old department? Well, astronomy and physics used to be in one, and then geology was its own thing. And there's been a reshuffling, yeah. No, physics is still separate, but of course there's a lot of talk in between. Yeah, they're all in this new thing, yeah. And as part of it, there's this big push now in cosmology, but that's joint with physics, ironically. But there'll be a number of more hires, and there's postdoc positions and stuff. There's an ad if you look in the AAS, and it says we're hiring almost anything, right? So, come check us out. So I'd like to tell you about a little bit about some different work that is either recent or something that was done a little bit while ago or something that's going on now to do with different populations of old stars. And it's divided in three parts. I'll tell you a little bit about some work we're doing constraining the spatial distributions of the first star in the halo. And then the rest will be about globular clusters. Before I jump into all that, I'll tell you about work that was done with a whole bunch of people, some of which are here. So there's Dasuke Kawata, who, he was at Carnegie. Where did he move to, actually?
Now he's gone to the University of Central Lancashire.
Okay, so he's moved to the UK. He moved again.
Oh, he's
at this place. I can't even keep up with my collaborators. There's Chris, who you know. Brad Gibson, who also moved. Everybody moves. A couple of people that I know from Italy. Then I'll tell you the globular cluster work I did with these two guys here who are at Los Alamos. Frank Harlow is a really great guy. He actually invented the particle and cell method. So he's been doing this, like, just about forever. And I know him from when I was in high school. This is my grad student, Will Gray, who's doing some simulations I'll show you at the end. So starting with the first stars, so the idea here, so here is a figure from this famous paper by Tom and Bell and collaborators showing this formation of the very first star in the universe. And the idea here is you don't have, H2 is basically the only coulomb that you have. And it takes you up to this typical density of about 10 to the 4 centimeters cubed in about 100 degrees K as you collapse. And then you go into LTE, and it's not a very efficient coolant. You can ask, what's the Jeans mass under these conditions? And you get this high mass. And then there's lots of papers written about how they expect these first stars to be extremely massive and perhaps very different than what we see today. Here's some words about different supernovae. So I was talking about this morning a little bit. So this is a plot by Alex Hager and Stan Woolsey trying to relate the masses of stars to their final fates. And we have this idea that within this range, say, of about 8 or 9 to, say, 30 solar masses, you have core collapse supernovae of various types. And then out here at this extremely high mass, you have these funny what are called pair instability supernovae that explode by there's explosive burning that disrupts them, so there's no bounce or anything like that. They just get into a temperature range where you have explosive burning in the core, and they disrupt themselves. And the question is, do the remnants of these sorts of things, whether they were this or this, have anything to do with the abundances that we see in halo stars? So if you look at halo stars, there's many surveys. So this is from Segway, I guess. This is a survey by Tim Beers. I guess people are part of this here. And showing some abundances of different stars here. So here you have Fe over H, and here you have carbon over Fe. And there's there's some very strange stars where there's almost no iron at all, or 10 to the minus 5 solar but a lot of carbon. And the question is, are these really stars that were just enriched by one neighbor? Are these stars that formed under primordial conditions and they were enriched only by one object? Or is there something else have to be going on here? Do these abundances and what we're measuring really have anything to do with what was going on when you're forming the first stars?
Weren't there a few papers saying that these were peculiar stars, or these metal abundances were not necessarily indicative of the actual metallicity of the star?
Is this Kim Vance?
Yeah,
Kim. Oh, has this been called into question? This axis here has been called?
No, the source of the carbon.
We had this discussion during the meeting.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you add a little bit of carbon to a very metal four star, then you'll get that kind of
ratio. Right. Right, but the weird thing is that, you know, the iron is so low. So if you're starting with some gas that was enriched, you'd imagine there would already be some iron. So it's funny that you're adding a little bit of something.
I just wonder whether it's clear that these are really, you know, simple stars where you can just make these measurements and everything's fine, or whether there are things like what Josh is saying.
So the So if you're talking about the Kim Van argument, then obviously Nova Christie and Anna Ferry will push back really hard on that. And right now the zinc measurements are crucial because if it's this weird dust separation, then you expect zinc to be very prominent because zinc does not go into dust. But if it's actually not having a lot of iron peak, then you expect zinc to be very low. And right now they're tantalizingly, annoyingly upper limits that should get better really soon to answer that question.
So it's still a possibility, that suggestion?
It's a possibility. It is,
But what's the suggestion?
The real annoying problem is that they're exactly at the wrong phase of evolution for this to be the case. They're not at the same point of evolution as like the Lambda Blue stars. So that's a concern. Why? Maybe subgiants.
I'm sorry, since I wasn't here for the meeting, so what was the suggestion? What is that?
If you look in space, there are things like these Lambda Blue stars, which are A-type stars, which have very, very low absorption from iron in their atmospheres, but it's not because they don't have iron. It's because the iron has depleted onto grains or other things that happened in the atmosphere so that your gaseous phase iron is not up to snuff. And so Kim Venn made a very provocative plot a couple of years ago pointing out that volatiles like carbon and oxygen are exactly the kind of things you expect to be in these atmospheres, whereas iron you don't expect to be in these atmospheres if this is what's going on. So you expect to get high carbon, low iron, ta-da. So
this axis maybe.
So that could explain why you have the hypermetal four stars are extremely rich in carbon and extremely not in iron, but there are several. So as I said, the zinc measurements are crucial, and the other problem is that nobody knows how to make. They have an explanation for Lambda Blue stars. They do not have an explanation for why a subgiant with a fairly dense atmosphere, fairly hot atmosphere, should have this going on at all. So that's
interesting.
So stay tuned. So hopefully in the next few years that'll be solved.
All right. So you know. So there may be some questions as to whether you should really trust this axis completely.
Right. So that is really only applying to the hypermetal core stars because the things down there with carbon. So the things at minus four with normal carbon. There's no way those can be explained by any kind of these arguments. It's really.
And then also you just have the point that you never actually yes.
How do you measure these polynomialities, which with line?
I don't know.
Usually the K line?
No, those are all of those are based on iron. They have iron lines.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
The carbon? I don't know.
And the carbon lines, right. They have iron and they have carbon lines, right. So
they're not inferred through some other.
It's high resolution. There's no extrapolation like this.
Right. Okay. And then the other point is just that, you know, we've never found a star that's metal free, right, ever. So the question is, are we even really looking in the right place? Is the halo a good place to really look for this? And why might it not be a good place? So here is a plot now from this paper by Jörg Diemann and collaborators. I think Mike Cullen has maybe done updated versions of this sort of thing with some permutation of these authors as well. But anyway, the point here is it's showing different, so here what they've done is taken particles that collapsed in halos of different sigmas. So rarer halos, and they've asked, where do they end up? So this is a simulation that's run all the way to now, and it's forming a Milky Way galaxy. And you ask, where do the dark matter particles that first collapsed in 3.5 sigma peaks, 3 sigma peaks, 2.5 sigma peaks, end up in this final distribution? And you find that these rare halos, the ones that should have collapsed first, are all sort of extremely centrally concentrated relative to the overall distribution. So it may be the case that these first stars, these very early stars, are all sort of buried somewhere in the bulge where, you know, they're sort of swamped by other populations and you'll never ever find them just because they're all sitting there.
I said never ever.
Well, maybe not never ever, but
just never.
Just never. Not anytime soon. Right? So maybe we're just talking about stuff that has nothing to do with the first star. Here's a paper, some results from a paper by White and Springle, which they did a similar thing. Here they plot, it's again a Milky Way simulation, it's a dark matter simulation that gives a halo. I forget what the mass is here, but around 10.
It's a cluster simulation.
Is it a cluster simulation? All right.
It's still down.
But they've done the same thing. You know, they've taken the 1% of the oldest collapsed objects and they plotted their radial distributions, and they're all very, very centrally concentrated. But then in this plot, they said, well, maybe we're looking at the wrong thing. Maybe we shouldn't look at the oldest things. Maybe we should look at the lowest mass halos that formed over a range of redshifts. And those are, of course, much more spread out. And I said, well, we don't really know. So we wanted to do a little bit better than that. Right? So and we wanted to really say, okay, well, where would you really expect stars to be forming out of gas that was initially of primordial composition? Where do those stars end up? Not just identifying some sigma or some redshift, but really trying to keep track a little bit of where that those metals ought to go and where you'll have primordial and enriched objects. So we carried out another n-body simulation that gives a Milky Way mass halo. So here we formed a 8 times 10 to the 11 solar mass galaxy. Okay, it was a dark matter only simulation. And what we did was we said, okay, within this simulation, we can identify halos reliably down to this atomic cooling limit that's been discussed before. So we can't go down to the very, very, very first stars, such as in this Bell paper. But we can go down to the atomic cooling limit. So if these stars were efficient at dissociating molecular hydrogen, then you probably wouldn't have very many of these very, very tiny halos forming stars. Rather, most of them would have collapsed within halos that can form atomically. And we can track all of those within this dark matter simulation. And then we said, well, for each one of those, every time we have a halo, we're going to associate the innermost dark matter particles with stars that we're going to form in that halo. And we'll track them, and we'll use them to figure out where those stars are going to end up in the final galaxy. So it goes something like this. So for each halo, we say that the center 10% of the baryon mass is going to go into stars, and we tag the inner 10% of the dark matter particles as sort of where those stars are going to end up. And then we then placed an outflow that's modeled as a shell, okay, sort of like this, that moves out and enriches the surrounding medium. Okay, and then when you have another object that's forming nearby, you can track that object and you can say, did it lie outside of all these spheres where you would have enrichment from the first stars? Okay?
Which internal function do you use for your first star?
So I'll get to that. So here you have the first star is forming and you generate a shell like this. Okay? Now here you have an object and it's collapsing within one of these shells, okay, that is enriched by the first stars. And so we call that a second star because it's enriched by the first stars, but not any other type of stars before it forms.
So you're saying that these first stars don't self-enrich, like that's like really a single population?
Yeah, that's right. So all we can say is that all we're trying to do is track stars that formed within halos that were initially primordial. I can't say anything about what happens within that cluster that of stars that may have formed there. So there can be self-enrichment that goes on. But you expect the gas to have initially been metal-free. So here you have some stars that collapse somewhere where it was only enriched by the first stars. Okay, and here you have something that's forming outside of all such shells. We also...
Snapshot, I guess. Snapshot, run a friends of friends, find the inner, and then you do another...
So you have a series of snapshots, and you say, okay, well, now I have these many halos that are new. So for each one of them, I'll check to see if I am within an enriched region.
Some are old that are grown and become more massive, so how do you keep track of those?
Right, well, so if you're older and more massive, then you'll be inside of one of these shells already. So you'll have a you won't be a first star because you'll be within one of these shells, because your own progenitor enriched you, right? Does that make sense? Right, and also, well, let me get through this. So here you have the first, and you have the second stars here that are enriched purely by the first star. And you can put shells around them too, and anybody that's enriched by second stars or any later generation, well, you just call that, population one or two stars. So, so Julio asks, like, what happens if you have a progenitor halo? Well, in this case, you'll be within this sphere, so you won't be counted again. And the other thing is, you don't have to worry about, so let's say you have some first stars here and you put a shell, and later you have you form a bigger object here, and you might worry about, well, am I putting too many shells? Should I account for the fact that there were stars here? But it doesn't matter. You can put multiple shells because you're looking for the thing that's outside of all of them. So you don't have this problem of, once you sort of make such a region that's enriched by first stars, you don't have to worry about multiple generations because they only make things worse and you're looking for what's outside.
You're looking for places that collapse that for a period of time, they're relatively isolated from the surrounding.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
The bubble in terms of the radius.
Right. And then since we don't know much about such stars, we can vary the amount of energy that we put in these shells over a huge range. Okay, and so we did that over about an order of magnitude. So for every, so if you had a saltpeter IMF, you would have about 10 to the 51 ergs of energy put in for every 300 solar masses of stars that you formed. Okay, and that sort of corresponds to this moderate, well, and then some fraction of that would actually be channeled into this outflow. So if you take a saltpeter mass function and you say that the amount of energy that I put into this outflow is about 10%, then you get this moderate model here. Okay, but then if you had an IMF that was tilted to these very massive stars, then you had more energy per solar mass of baryons formed. So you drive these shells much more strongly. And that'd be the strong model where we put 10 times more energy in. And we also considered a very weak model. Okay, so we took a huge range of the amount of energy we can put in these shells. Okay, so even though it's a little bit crude just having a shell, the uncertainties are so large that you're swamped by not knowing the amount of energy that you should put in these sort of enrichment. Okay, so is it sort of clear what we're doing? Or, yes. All right, so I don't have a movie of this, but this is a plot now of these distributions. So this is all the dark matter particles at redshift 10. These are the halo particles. And these are the ones that are forming in regions that weren't pre-enriched. And these are the ones that are enriched purely by the first stars, so the first and second. Most of them are first and second stars. They're pretty centrally concentrated. And that's a redshift 10. Now, as you move down to redshift 6, these regions in the center have already been enriched, but you're still forming new ones further out. Right, even at lower redshift, you're forming new first stars, stars that haven't been pre-enriched by other generations. Because there's just not that, these distances are pretty big, right? So they're, this is 400 kiloparsecs across. This is physical size. And the difference in time between redshift 6 and 10 is not that long. So really, no matter how much energy you put in, even if you go to this maximal model, it's very hard to get something to go from here all the way out to here. So you continue to form stars out of metal for gas, even even at late times, but just further out. And then when you get to lower redshift, the formation is sort of, you're sort of done forming, but now you have all these objects with a variety of distances from the center of the of where you're forming this Milky Way object. If you go down all the way to redshift zero, you find that you kind of have this cloud, both of first and second stars. So you have this distributed distribution of both first and second stars, just because they form at a range of radii. Okay. So this is summarizing for these three different models, the very strong enrichment model, this sort of fiducial model, and the very weak enrichment model. The rate at which we're forming these metal-free stars as a function of redshift. And in all cases, they peak at high redshift, but then you have this tail dropping down where you're forming stars far out. Okay? So there's a peak at redshift 10, but it continues down to about redshift 5.
And so, this is just telling you that the weaker the feedback is, the weaker these bubbles are, the sort of larger fraction of space remains uncontaminated, so that you can still form at redshift zero almost for stars.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not dramatic. So even if I change its energy by a factor of 100, this plot hasn't sort of changed dramatically.
It hasn't, but if you look at when you can find the last first star between strong and weak, right? Mm-hmm. You're done at redshift 5 finding first stars, but here you can go all the way to redshift 2.
Yeah, so
that's
that's true. So you have a longer tail, and in this one, you have sort of more of these second stars that have only been enriched by the first generation because you put so much energy into it.
Is that bump sort of real, or is that just like?
It's just statistics, I think. There's no.
Okay.
No.
That's right. Okay.
This guy here. No, I don't. This one?
Yes.
That's just like, one object that's far out.
One object, right?
It's definitely one object.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very far out. And then you could work out a radial distribution of these. So this is now for these three different models. So this is the weak, moderate, and strong feedback models. And this is the radial distribution of the density of such stars relative to the total dark matter distribution. And the slope's pretty much the same, so this is normalized now by the total mass. And for this sort of fiducial numbers where we're taking 10% of the baryons and converting into stars, you get this ratio of about 3,000. So that's the density of such stars in the halo, say, relative to the mass. So it's a lot. And the second stars are sort of similar. They vary a little bit more in terms of the number that you get, whether you have strong or weak feedback. But the main conclusion is that it's almost impossible not to get these first and second stars to sort of end up everywhere. Right? So it's impossible to sort of hide these stars all in the bulge. They tend to be in fair numbers where you can see them.
Another generation,
yeah, see, I wouldn't do that because, see, all we have is a dark matter simulation. So I could say, well, I can find these halos pretty well, and if I'm talking about early halos, maybe they form little tiny disks and then the stars end up in the middle. But all of that sort of motion, the impact of how much gas is going to, or gas shocking and gas processes are going to move those stars around within my simulation is probably not large. Whereas when I get to sort of later forming, maybe when I have a disk in place and things like that, then I wouldn't.
It depends on when this happens, right?
Yeah. So, what I'm.
In some simulations, like for example, in the demon, and we've also done something similar.
Yeah.
You do find that, say, an R to the minus 3.5, so much more centrally concentrated than the dark matter for what you would call perhaps the population 2. You would kind of do the match with the halo and the population 2. So I was wondering if you also get the same thing, in the sense that at least at some point, you know, how do you normalize, how do we know this model works in the end, right?
That's
a good point, but I think it might be very difficult to reproduce something you know without any gas motion. So like,
but I mean, even that could do it too, with just semi-analytic model and dark matter simulation, just like you do.
Okay, so
I think it's clear that if you take, you know, the most massive progenitors and just look at the inner parts of those will end up more centrally concentrated. And I guess the trick here that you're doing is you will allow any stars to form everywhere above hydrogen pulling limit. And therefore, you form stars even in very, very small objects almost all times, except for a aperture or two or so.
Right. So, I mean, the only thing that I'm doing is saying, okay, well, wherever I form a halo, well, that's above the atomic cooling limit, then I form some stars there. That's all I've done. I haven't tried to. Well, I mean, you could make this as complicated as you want for the other generations, right? You could say, okay, now I have some feedback and these ones don't form stars and all kinds of things, right? But I'm just saying I'll try to tag the ones that are forming outside of anywhere I could expect.
The collection of stars, the first stars.
Yeah.
Varies dramatically with the halo mass in which you form them. Imagine you form, you know, 1 in 100 solar massive baryons in a very small one and 100 of 100, a big one. Like, you know, global clusters, they all form more or less the same time somehow.
Yeah, right.
I don't know why, but it seems to be the case. Imagine you form a global cluster in a big thing and one star in a small object per baryon mass. When you do all this at the end, you're dominated by the most massive ones, and you never see the small ones. And the resulting distribution would be, you know, drastically declining, the greatest of them.
So
which is how you weight. Basically, you're assuming a constant efficiency as function of mass.
So, what basically happens is if you have a range of masses over which you're forming stars, it's always your lowest mass that dominates this first star formation. Right? So if I allow some range, even if I make star formation much more efficient at higher masses, these guys, they like to live far away from any of their other neighbors. So as soon as some halo peaks over the minimum mass at which I expect it to start forming stars, basically that's it. So I collapse, I form my first stars, and after that.
Yeah, imagine that forms only one star, whereas the bigger one will form 10,000. When you put them all together and you just weight by mass, what would be the rate of distribution than when you're presenting here?
Well, the radial distribution of the first stars would be the same. Right, so all those high-mass objects would contain pre-enriched stars. It would just sort of lower this. If you don't like my number of the amount of stars I put in, you can just lower that. But the radial distribution wouldn't change. The radial distribution only depends on the minimum threshold mass, and that's it. And the total number, this total normalization is more uncertain because I don't know the efficiency at that low mass. So I can move that up and down a lot easier than I can change its profiles. Right.
So the reason you get such a different answer from Yerg is just that you're not forming stars in the high sigma peaks, right?
Well, I am, but I'm also forming it in lower sigma peaks.
Yeah,
I'm saying
you're doing both.
Forming everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying that this guy here is not a high sigma peak.
Yeah.
But it doesn't care, right? I mean, there's nothing around him, and physical conditions here are not so different than they were for this guy a little bit earlier. So I expect this to be the same.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Do you have a UV factor or limitation or something that would prevent the formation of these things later on, or that is not included in the model?
Yeah, I mean, you can do that. So if you put in a very early reionization and then just jump up with the mass, then you can change the radial profile.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. But, and you can see when that would matter, right? So,
yeah.
Like, 7 is not a big deal. But if you start to say, well, nothing can collapse right at 10, then you could get a bigger impact. So that is a caveat. Okay? And then here you just have a little bit about the orbits of these stars. So they tend to be a little bit more on radial orbits at a given, if you ask about what's, this is an anisotropy parameter here, where you're measuring tangential velocity dispersion versus radial, they tend to kind of be things that are coming in like this, right? Because this guy formed out here and later fell in, so it tends to be a little bit more more in a radial orbit. But it's not a strong effect. Then we tried it again. So Chris has this, he can tell you a little bit more about it. But we did it again with gas and dark matter using their code GCD plus. And we couldn't get down to the atomic cooling limit with the gas around. But essentially the same story. And here are the results. Now for simulation where the dark matter mass is 8 times 10 to the 6. It's about 10 times higher. But again, you get the very oldest stars centrally concentrated. But if you ask, what are all the stars forming in areas that were not enriched when you started star formation, you get a much more flat distribution. So almost anything you do gives you that. So I think what you can take away from this is that the halo is actually a pretty good place to look. And the fact that we haven't seen any metal-free stars probably does place a constraint on the minimum mass of those stars. Now, of course, that was a long time ago, so it doesn't need to be 100 solar masses, but it's very difficult to have forming lots of metal-free stars with masses less than about 0.8 m solar, because they would still be there. We haven't seen any. And also, all the metallicities and abundances that we observe, if they're reliable, and these very metal-poor stars are actually telling us something about these first generations. So really, you can't bury them. And this is just a Derby map that we added the positions of all the stars that formed, I believe, above redshift 12, I think. And we compared them to these first stars. So the first stars are everywhere, but the oldest stars are all buried in the bulge. Okay? All right, so now I'd like to move on and tell you about some other work that we did related to globular cluster population.
Wait, before you move on.
Yeah, sure.
You should really look in the centers of dwarfs to get the first oldest stars, the oldest first stars.
Just you should look.
There's less other stars there.
The dwarfs. I find the dwarfs in the center, they tend to be lower signature, so
right.
They're not going to form the oldest stars.
Well, no, you would form the youngest first stars there. So the dwarves are a good place to look, but you'd form the youngest first stars there.
Well, they're pretty old, right? I mean, like,
who cares?
Well, I mean, everything's old here, right? I mean, you know, I mean, right? So it's did you form at redshift 10 or at 7? I mean.
Well, wait a second. Can you just go back to your picture, your redshift 10 picture? Because you show, I mean, they're forming everywhere. So in the centers of some little dwarfy thing, right? Because you're forming in any low signal heap.
Right.
Hasn't fallen in yet to the Milky Way, but you still have old first stars that are in some little guy.
Yeah, but that's at redshift 10. So certainly this guy here, although he's a dwarf redshift 10, is going to end up, you know, stripped of, you know,
sure,
a redshift 4 and be somewhere in the halo, right? But then this guy, maybe this one, is not necessarily going to be
right.
In the Milky Way itself. And in fact, if you look at that map, you see that there's structure in it, right? So there's kind of this cloud, but then there's these clumps here, and each one of those is like a dwarf.
Those are first stars, and those are oldest stars.
These are the oldest stars. They're all very centrally concentrated. These are the first stars. They're sort of all over the place, but they are clumped up occasionally in these dwarfs.
Right.
That is a good place.
Basically, every system that remains physically detached today has some first stars.
Yeah, I mean, or it did. So the point is, every system that was physically detached, and also the halo, should contain stars that originally formed out of metal-poor gas. That's what I could say. Out of metal-free gas. So I don't know if there was self-enrichment, and I don't know if those stars are still there. But
So what tells you that these dark galaxies are completely isolated from their surroundings?
What tells you that?
Yeah. So the first star that falls in the dwarf galaxy may be already included. If the gas that fell in was already included.
Yeah, but that's the whole point, that I tracked all the halos that collapsed in areas where the gas was not enriched before that halo collapsed. So you know that, the one thing you know is that when that gas started to collapse and cool and form stars, there weren't any metals there. That's the one thing that we've tracked. I don't know anything about self-enrichment within it.
That's about the observed dwarf galaxies today. How do we know that the first generation of stars were formed from pristine gas?
I don't think we do. The question is, can you just try to hammer on their abundances and see if you find any of those little clusters down here?
Right. So the question, I think the question is, when you look at these abundances, are you learning it? Are you putting any constraints on that? Should you, the fact that you don't see a metal-free star, does that mean anything? And the abundances that you do see, if they're really weird, are they telling you about these early generations, or are you just looking at something completely different? Right? And I would say that you are learning about this from looking there.
So you should have a map of metallicity in IGM, right?
There's not a map of metallicity because, we're just drawing these spheres, right? And then later generations are enriching things to much more higher metallicity levels, but I just care about placing.
But you have the filling factor of metal-free gas.
I could plot that, yeah.
I was just wondering if you could reproduce, the fact that we haven't seen any lines of sight with metal-free gas.
And then in an intergalactic medium?
True.
Well, this is just a Milky Way simulation, so. If you play the same game with a cosmological simulation, you don't get that the entire IGM is enriched. You get something like 15%.
So is that consistent with?
Yeah, that's completely consistent. Observations.
Okay.
Okay, but that's another.
How is it we haven't seen any line of sight that doesn't have that?
Just probed like zero volume so far, even with a lot of
they've always found like carbon 2 or whatever. I thought they had the cases where like they lined in limit systems or whatever where you couldn't, there were limits, but it's really hard not to.
We need to do like a Sloan level survey with in absorption lines because we probe like just very little volume at high resolution where people have metallicity. So it's just really.
That's right.
Very, very few sight lines that we've proved. So you can do anything. You just see 10 to minus 3 everywhere, but.
Yeah. There's a huge scatter in metallicity in the IGM, and there's plenty of room for big swaths that are not, especially at redshift 2. It's just a messy business. Any more on this? All right, well, let's see how far we get with this other thing. So I guess you've been talking a lot about globular clusters. These are a few intro slides on them. I'll just go through them fast. So here's a distribution of absolute magnitude here. This is basically the number of stars in globular clusters consistent with the mass. Well, here's log m over m sun. There's about 10 to the 5 stars plus or minus 0.5. And it's roughly a Gaussian. Here's their sizes. And there's some unusual properties of globular clusters. Maybe you've already discussed them. But we want to come up with some sort of idea of where these came from. There's several things that we need to explain. First one is if you plot up their masses and their sizes. So this is a plot here of their log, their mass, and here's the half-light radius. And this is at different galactic centroid radii. And this is a plot from Castellani and Caputo. And you have here different destruction mechanisms for globular clusters. So there's disk shocking, so these things are going around, they pass through the disk, and they're eventually disrupted if they're too sort of puffy. So that places an upper line here. If they're too compact, they'll evaporate. And then you have dynamical friction. Eventually, they'll sort of spiral into the center if they're too massive. And the observed range of globular clusters is consistent with this shocking setting, this upper size scale, and an evaporation setting, the minimum size scale. But then you have this sort of maximum mass that doesn't seem to be set by some dynamical process, seems to be something intrinsic to the population, the initial globular cluster population. So you have this upper mass limit. And then you have, this is now a plot of the metallicity. This is the average metallicity of different globular clusters. And you have these two populations. So a high metallicity population with a mean of about a third solar, and a low metallicity population with a mean about a 30th solar. They're often called red and blue. These are like the swing globular clusters in the middle. But so there's this big range, but within each one of them, you have a the blue is winning. But within any individual one, so you have this is a big range in metallicities, but each one has a very narrow scatter in the. The differences in the metallicities of the individual stars. So.
That's stunning.
But there are complications with this, right? So there's now globular clusters where you see multiple main sequences, but those differences are very small compared to this sort of a thing, right? So to zero or almost first order, there's one generation of stars here. Although there's maybe hints that maybe there are. Small differences in metallicities, multiple populations. But in general, compared to other stellar populations, you have very little scatter. And then this is just a plot on tidal tails showing that globular clusters are at least consistent with having no dark matter. They certainly can't have enormous mass-to-light ratios like you would in most dwarfs, with certain caveats. So you have these three properties. You have this sort of maximum limit that you'd like to understand, the fact that there's a very small scatter, and that there's no dark matter. So we could go back to this population here that's sitting around. So here you have this atomic cooling limit above which you can cool and form stars, and below which you have these halos that if there's no atomic no molecular hydrogen around, it's very difficult for them to form stars. So below this temperature here, you need dust or H2 to cool. And you wouldn't have that in the early universe. And it turns out that this limit, especially at redshift 10, is pretty much consistent with this upper mass, right? So the masses of these objects are sort of consistent with the masses of stars you might expect to make if you could somehow take some fraction of these halos that can't cool atomically and get them to cool and form stars. Okay, so
what kind of efficiency would you
need? Something similar, like 10%. Something like that.
But M31 has more massive globules. I mean, you look at bigger systems, you get much more massive things. Are you just going to discard them all and call them all omega-7?
Well, I don't know. Are there?
How can the GCLF be so similar?
I mean, like Omega Sen, has a big, pretty much, except for maybe this. None of it's true. What I just told you. But
it's true that larger populations of global clusters sort of populate the high mass tail. That's all I'm saying.
So what's the most massive globular cluster where it's clearly a globular cluster? So.
Well, I mean, you know what we can do with omega. You can't do that in M31, so I don't know. But G1 is massive.
Yeah, but that's another one that you can say about the cluster.
Yeah, so that was my...
So as far as I know, there's no clear-cut example where... you have this small sort of scatter and all everything else we associate with globular cluster, you have a large, you have a mass of the hair. All right. Okay, so we have this population that's sitting around, and if we could somehow turn it and get it to form stars, it might look something like a globular cluster. At the same time, we know that high redshift galaxies are driving out big winds of material. This is now an old plot, right? But in which they've taken just a sample of 19 Lyman-Rigg galaxies, in which they have infrared and optical spectra. And with the, so what do you see? So in the optical spectra, you see redshifted absorption lines, so mostly carbon-4. And you also see Lyman alpha emission. And with the infrared spectrum, you have the nebular lines that give you the redshift of these objects. And for each one, you can ask, what is the offset between the absorption lines that you see and the systemic velocities of these galaxies? And what is the difference in redshift between the emission lines and the systemic redshift? And what you see is that essentially all this gas that you see absorption is flowing at you. It's coming out with typical velocities around 200, 300 kilometers a second. And Lyman alpha is systematically redshifted. And again, that's something you would expect if you have an outflow, because it's only the photon that scatters off of the back of this outflowing shell that will then be able to pass through the front without being scattered by some hydrogen that's in front of it. Right, so this is both of these measurements here are consistent with having large velocity outflows around pretty much every starbursting galaxy, a high redshift. Okay, so what if we put these two things together? So we have this population of halos that are sitting around waiting for something to happen. And what if one is overtook by one an outflow from a high redshift galaxy? Maybe not at redshift 3, but a similar galaxy earlier on. So here's sort of a fiducial, this is a complicated plot of what would happen in such an interaction, in which we took some fiducial model. We said, okay, imagine I have some wind that I power with 10 to the 56 ergs, that's about, 100,000 supernovae. And it overtakes some halo with this mass, right? So about 3 million solar masses. And I put that halo such that the impinging amount of metals in that wind would enrich it to a typical metallicity that we see for this halo globular cluster. So I'll just say that there's a wind, and I'll move that halo to a distance at which that wind has now expanded to the point that the impinging metals would enrich it to a metallicity that I'd sort of see in a globular cluster. Now you can ask the question, what would happen in such an interaction? So here is a plot of the impact parameter out from the center of that halo that's of which the wind has, that's being hit by that wind. So, and as a function of radius, you can ask, after that shock, what will be the free fall time? What will be the sound crossing time? What will be the cooling time for the gas at those various radii? Okay, so here you have the free fall time as a function of the impact parameter in that cloud. And here you have the sound crossing time after the shock has overtaken the cloud. Okay, so the sound crossing time is much shorter than the free fall time, so you'd expect this thing would just be blown up by this collision, right? It's heated much higher than its virial temperature because it's been overtaken by this wind. But the point is that cooling is very efficient, right, when you get up to these post-shock temperatures, which are about 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6. It cools very quickly. It cools in much less than a sound crossing time. Okay, so even though it's overtaken by this wind, it wouldn't be disrupted because it would cool right back down. So this plot here is what happens when it gets back down to 10 to the 4. Okay, so now we have the post-shock, so this is the sound crossing time when it gets back down to 10 to the 4. And this is now the free fall time and the cooling time when it's cooled back down. So it's shocked, but then it cools and condenses. And now, not only does it condense to the point where it can collapse within a sound crossing time, but it also can cool past 100,000 degrees because now it has two coolants that were not in place before this shock overtook it. So And those coolants are, one, molecular hydrogen, because when you shock the cloud, even though it originally had no molecular hydrogen, you ionize it, the atomic hydrogen, and when it recombines, you have non-equilibrium production of molecular hydrogen. So not all of the electrons sort of find their proton friends again. Some of the electrons end up finding atomic hydrogen and creating H minus, and that catalyzes the production of molecular hydrogen. So all of a sudden, when you shock it and then it cools back down, now you have this molecular hydrogen in a place that wasn't there before it was overtaken by the shock. At the same time, you're bringing in these coolants, and especially carbon-2, iron-2, and silicon-2 can cool things below 10 to the 4 degrees.
Yeah, what sort of maximum temperature does it reach when the shock overtakes it?
Well, the shock overtakes it about 100, 200 kilometers a second and reaches maximum temperatures between 10 to the 5 and a million. So it's kind of near the peak of the cooling curve, so it cools pretty quick. At least for this fiducial interaction.
And it deposits metals, so you also have the metals cooling.
Yeah, right. Right, so the
frequency of this configuration is in Milky Way gamma material simulation. How many times does it happen?
All right, so, hold on a sec. Well, I'm going to show you is that we did parameter dependencies, and then you can ask over the range of separations and globular cluster masses and halo masses that you would expect to give you globular clusters, do you get number densities that are consistent with what you see? Is that's sort of your question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and those numbers are hard to get, but they're roughly consistent. So it's not that I require all of these mini halos to turn into globular clusters. It's only a very small fraction that actually have to be sort of near a wind that hits them with the right sort of velocity to get them to form stars. At the same time, interestingly, you give this thing a kick, and the kick is big enough to kick it out of its dark matter halo, which may or may not have something to do with the fact that globular clusters don't have dark matter halo now. They may have lost that later, but in this sort of scenario, they lose it right at the same time that you form stars and enrich it. So you do everything at once. You create the stars, you enrich them, and you get rid of the halo. So then we did parameter studies where you move this thing further and closer away. And you find that over these distances that are associated with metallicities of about 1,000 to 10th solar, that this process works pretty well. If you bring it in closer than that, then you get into trouble. You just destroy your cloud. If you bring it in further away, you're just kind of tapping on it and nothing much happens.
So that's the critical thing because you're hitting this thing at 300, you're hitting a halo at whatever, 200 kilometers a second. You got to heat it up, make the stars, and get it. I mean, what are the typical, and then kick the cluster out of the halo.
Right.
So so then to all of them, and then you have just a shell of these things that have the right sort of.
Yeah, right. So you end up with kind of like here's the starbursting galaxy, and you have the shell of these things that are sort of in the right range to have this happen. And that you would expect them to get enriched at sort of the metallicities that you see.
How strong are the kicks?
Are they enough to sort of change the
orbit signal? Yes, right, so they strip it right out of the halo. So the kicks, the momentum in the kicks is, it doesn't drastically exceed the escape velocity times the mass of the gas, but it's a few times order that. But it depends if I put it, the distance that I put it from the center. Okay, this is more parameter studies. Well, it's three, so I want to skip to the last thing. Now, in that paper, we kind of understood the point here that if you really want to create this homogeneous population and get these coolants in, you have to mix them in before the thing kind of collapses on its own because you have molecular hydrogen. So you're playing this delicate game where now you've triggered star formation, but maybe you've triggered it too efficiently. because it's cooling by non-equilibrium processes, and can you get these metals mixed in before that sort of star formation is already over. And we did some 1D estimates, so this is some 1D simulations that we did in that paper, and it was sort of marginal, we couldn't tell. So now I want to show you some simulations that a student is doing with me, trying to study this sort of scenario in much more detail. And these are all work in progress, so I won't be able to give you a final conclusion on any of these. So the idea is to go back and recreate that scenario that I showed you, but now simulate everything using this code, Flash 3, which is an adapted mesh code. So we started with an initially hydrostatic gas sitting in an NFW halo. And the runs that I'll show you, we used four levels of refinement. So essentially, it's 256 cube resolution. We could do better than that if we need to. And they were all run at ASU. The nice thing about Flash is, it's very modular, so it's very easy to add things and pull out. And it takes care of all the message passing for you. It didn't used to have self-gravity, but now it does. So it was of limited use for sort of cosmology type problems, but now it's got self-gravity. So I'll just show you one of those runs that we did. So here's a movie that was generated with some visualization software that they wrote for us there at ASU.
What do you mean no cooling?
Yeah, so the problem here is the only runs I can show you are going to be ones with no cooling except for something at the end, because we're still working on that. Okay. So I can't give you the final version of the story for this reason.
Nothing, no atomic cooling, nothing.
No. Right, there's no cooling. And it turns out atomic cooling is the biggest problem. So that's where we're hung up now. But I'll say something on that in a second. So here, this is easier, I think, to look at. Here's a slice through the center of this thing, and you have the wind overtaking it. There's a shell, and then you'll see the shell. That's the end of the shell, and then we have the... right, so we put some shell material, and it's overtaking this thing, and that's the end of it there. And you see this thing's kind of getting ablated, and the problem is that, so you have like these ridges here, and what's going on is that you're pushing this dense gas here with less dense gas that's out here. And so you're driving this shock, and as it moves through, you get these unstable ridges over here. And if you go back in higher resolution, you see that things are more jaggedy. Okay, so I don't have movies for all these sorts of convergence studies. But the problem is that these are Rayleigh-Taylor unstable. Okay, so. Right, so whenever you're driving something dense with something cold, with something low density, you have this Rayleigh-Taylor instability that grows as time squared. Okay, so if you put a swimming pool over your head, that's not very sort of stable. There's a lot of potential energy there, and that would lead to mixing. So if you want to do this right, there's no way you can actually simulate it without having some sort of estimate of the mixing that's occurring on scales smaller than what you're resolving due to these instabilities. Right, so we spent quite a bit of time implementing a model that captures that sort of turbulence and those mixing on small scales. And it's something we want to apply to to many different problems. And so the way this works is you carry around two extra variables. One is a turbulent kinetic energy. The second one is a length scale. And you just invect these two around, okay? And the turbulent kinetic energy is increased by a source term. And right now, we're only able to track the Rayleigh-Taylor growth of instabilities. So you have here a buoyancy-driven source term that drives turbulence. Okay, so we can't track shear-driven turbulence yet. And that sort of tells you the kinetic energy that you expect in every cell due to these unresolved motions. Okay. At the same time, you have this length scale that you're advecting around, and it grows through those turbulent motions. So here, V is just the square root of 2 times square root of k. And it grows and contracts with the flow. So if you have a typical length scale and then you smush things down by 10, then this terminal length scale will go down by 10 just because you've, a shock has moved through and compressed things. So.
The thing is, if you're really cooling fast, I mean, so once you do have cooling in it, like, isn't it possible that you're actually going to form stars so quickly that you know, all these little filaments and stuff that you get on the edges maybe aren't.
Yeah, you know, the biggest problem, well, so, it's not clear, right? But right now, the biggest problem that we're having with turning on cooling is not the atomic cooling. It's this shock as it's propagating before it's even gotten to this halo right here. It has very short cooling times. And so that thing requires a lot of computer time to capture right, and it's not clear how we should be capturing the shell itself. That's the biggest problem that I have with cooling. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the question. Can you mix in the metals before you've cooled? Right? And then from those two, anyway, so you have that kinetic energy and you have that length scale. From those two things, you can build sort of a typical diffusion coefficient. So a length scale and a velocity make a diffusion coefficient. You can estimate the rate at which things are mixing across these regions that should be turbulent. Is it just the rest of this is just continuity equation, energy equation. Okay. So you can do that same simulation where now you include this turbulence model. It looks pretty different. So here you have the shock overtaking it. And now this looks smooth and you get a more diffuse sort of band where you've mixed in this enriched material over a wider range here. Yeah. So this is just showing those kinetic energies. So this shock here, I mean this, this shock moves through and heats up this material and drives turbulence with typical velocities of 10 to 30 kilometers a second, about a tenth of what the ordered velocities are. And the length scales are an order of sort of this structure size here. So this is comparing what you get in terms of metal mixing between the outside and the interior of this halo if you don't have this turbulence turn on. And if you do. So it makes a big difference.
This whole time is sitting for the, I mean, this is so this, the idea that this is this mixing is happening so fast that basically this gas is still at dead-free temperatures after the shock has passed. I mean, this, you know, it's, you know, because my question is.
Yeah, so in this case.
The stars are the mixing, you know what I mean? So you can.
Yeah, so it's kind of like it's overtaken by a shock and then there's a race.
Yeah.
And. The race is between can you mix in the metals faster than you cool? Right, and I don't know the answer. That's what we're trying to figure out. But right now, this is at a time of about 50 megayears. Okay, so that gives you sort of a rough time scale. Now, is that too long? I don't know yet because we haven't done the cooling. We did code up some primordial chemistry. And here's a test run that I'll show you. In which we just take such a halo and heat it up to 30,000 degrees and see what happens. Right, and so you get this thing cooling down to 10 to the 4 very quickly, and then it keeps going below that because now it has some molecular coolants that weren't there before. But this is still being tested. So I don't know. So we have all these pieces to figure out which happens quicker, but we haven't sort of been able to put them together quite yet.
And if you form one star, just like really quickly as the shock goes and it blows up, like one big star, then.
Well, the one thing that you know is what?
Right.
Well, the one thing you know is if you have this cloud, in the absence of dark matter, this thing is small enough that you would kind of just disrupt it with one supernova. So you don't want to.
That's what I'm.
Yeah. So self-enrichment.
That's why we don't see shells of globular, you know, many globular clusters, right? You know, you see a few globular clusters in every, you know, Virgo and Milky Way, but there's not like, you know.
Yeah, but this is all stuff that's happening at high redshift.
Right.
Right? At redshift 10. And then later, not only that cluster, but even that galaxy that enriched it fall into.
There's, what did Kulin say yesterday? 40,000 halos that are roughly this mass or something. What is it? 10,000?
4,000. Yeah, 4,000. But only some fraction of those are near some neighbor that happened to be at the right distance and drove a wind that was of the right strength to trigger star formation there. And then only some fraction of those, you know, are of the mass, you know, end up somewhere where they weren't disrupted for various reasons. You know, they weren't too low mass or too puffed up or too near the center of another galaxy. It's only some small fraction that you would expect to survive.
And these guys all have just the universal baryon fraction, right?
So yeah, right, initially, yeah. Yeah.
So what you're doing is taking away the gas from the dark matter, I don't know. So mm-hmm. Where do you form the stars? On this process, why it's going away?
Yeah, so here there's no coolant, so
So if you take
this thing is, if there were a coolant, would be much more compact. Right, and that's where I'm forming the stars. At the same time, there's enough momentum transfer here that this eventually just flies off the back. So if I extend this to bigger times, it just kind of flies off the back of this simulation.
Did it collapse again to have the profile of a globular cluster coming out of this gas that is going away? At the end, I mean, when...
Is it still gravitationally bound? Yeah, it would be. Right? So it's much more compact than it was. Right, so it's compressed initially, and then it cools down and gets smaller. So we would expect it to be gravitationally bound.
So it leaves the halo as a globular.
It leaves it as a right.
So it forms the stars in
right. In this collision, right? So the cooling times are pretty short. Right, so it kind of just boom, and then stars are forming as it sort of sprays off the back of this thing. And they should be dense enough to be gravitationally bound to each other. That's,
so does this work in the case of forming globular clusters in merger debris?
Right. So then,
but you've already got mixed gas, and you know this is to populate that nice red.
So if that you can't get. So if you try, no. So basically, there aren't these halos sitting around with gas and just waiting to do something at redshift 2. Right.
No, I was thinking.
So it can't. Yeah. They can't be the one. They can't.
I was thinking the globulars are forming at redshift a half. You know, people now say, oh, we make globulars in gaseous mergers.
Right. And...
But what you're saying, you don't have a dense enough knot of gas to...
I'm saying that has to be a somewhat different process because you... So you can't take a cloud... Well, first of all, a cloud like this wouldn't be in place at redshift of a half. And second of all... that to be purely enriched by, you know, something coming out during this merger, it would have to, you probably hit it way too hard. So it has to be some sort of other way to get a dense star cluster. Can't do this. Okay, I'm going way over. Okay, thanks.
Does anyone have any more questions? I think we can start now. So actually, Paul.
Oh, sorry.
Some results on infrared in Virgo.
We're talking about looking at infrared light during one of the MOM-T conversations, and I've got this is published, but I've got pictures. Real-time integration. This is Virgo as you might see it if you went out with a little telescope. And
can you point out a couple of galaxies? Or like
M87 and M86, I think. And this guy that he is the little spiral that's pancaking in and having all the gas above, which I can't remember. It's, no. And if we just move on a little bit. So what I'm going to do is just go down in depth. It's just an image, and we're just going to slice it and put light down to deeper and deeper levels. So it's 22.5 in the surface brightness. And, you know, we're starting to get to where, you know, what the sky survey images look like, or survey images of Virgo. Does it look more familiar now?
Yeah.
And if we go a little further, it's, you know, it's your typical CCD image on a telescope. And if we go a little further, and this field of view is like approximately 2 by 2 degrees.
And you've blacked out the bright stars?
Yeah, they're not black holes, they're bright stars. We subtract out all the stars and their wings, but the inner core is really hard to subtract precisely, so we can't do it well, we just blur it out. And we got a little further.
What are the images from?
The Borel-Schmidt telescope. So this is about 100 images, 80 images, and 15 minutes long, and a similar number of offset sky images. So it's a whole, you know, the whole time Virgo's up in the dark, you observe it when the weather works you. And then if we go a little further, this is about where Malin got to, a fraction further, where Malin got to by stacking dozens and dozens of photographic plates of Virgo together, and you could, is there a laser pointer? And you could just start to see this stream-like feature coming out of the equivalent or something. And you can see that the isotopes of M87 are not at all well-behaved. And the isotopes of these two galaxies, M86 and the one next to it, those two are not physically overlapping. One's about a megaparsec in front of the other. And if you keep going, things start to get interesting. You start to see tidal debris coming out here, and this feature becomes more obvious. You keep going a little further. You see there's quite a bit of tidal debris. There's multiple features coming out of here. We're pretty sure this is real because we've observed it on other runs extending this area, and it all shows up. And I guess you can go to some whatever unbelievability factor you want. I don't think we believe it at that level, but in a sense, we do believe that there's all this diffuse light around here. So the question is, what do you call intracluster light, and what do you call galaxy light? And this is work with Craig Ruddock and Chris Mihos, who's the lead author on the paper, at CASE. And Craig's working on modeling tearing galaxies apart and in cluster environments, you know, based on cosmological simulations and having stars on them. And comparing, so at the moment what they're doing is to compare the models to the data, and so other people can talk the same language. You just say below a certain surface brightness, you know, call it intracluster light, and above that you'll call it the galaxy. Because then anyone can translate. If you play other more complicated games, it's impossible to translate between papers. Anyway, the thing in here, what we don't see is shells, like you see some around isolated electricals. In here, the debris is more radial. And if you do unsharp masking or you subtract the profile out, there's more detail underneath here. And that's that'll be the subject of another paper. And we've imaged more of Virgo down over there somewhere around M49. You can't do it contiguously because you have to pick regions where there's low foreground galactic cirrus, high-electric cirrus. And so this is very conveniently in a nice hole. Once you start getting outside of this area too much, especially over here, you run into more size. And so you can sort of see pictures on your image that match the 10 micron image. Anyway, someone
when they use that simple definition, what proportion of the stars are in the image?
10-20%. But if you do a multi-component fit, say an M87, you say, I'm going to fit the central part with this outer profile, I'm going to fit the extended part with another profile that goes in, and you take the two profiles, you end up with a number much more like 40. In this case, or if you looked at some CD galaxies, you'd end up with 50%. So there's a lot of light, but it's not a lot of stars. You know, it's very diffuse.
Right.
And I don't believe that quite that far. You know,
this is another intercluster light, intergalactic light. And each galaxy seems to have its own halo that at some point they start to overlap. But
all the halos overlap, but the halos, you know, this stuff here, the one kinematic piece of evidence here is people have looked at the planetaries and the globular clusters around M87. And as you go, the velocity dispersion versus radius, and it comes down, and then it starts to go back up again. So presumably this is the halo and the potential of M87, and this is the halo and the potential of the cluster. Because M87 is sitting pretty much at the bottom. So, you know, at that stage, you're talking about the dark matter halo, the cluster, with the other galaxies being around. So.
Thanks, Paul, for...